if we keep our eyes not so much on each other's shortcomings and inadequacies, but keep our eyes on the prize, something bigger than us, something better than us, something grander than us that can appeal to the better angels of our nature, appeal to the best of us at a moment in which the worst of each and every one of us is being accented and accentuated. We're not going to save the world or save America, but we certainly can leave it much better than we found it if we're committed to the radical democratic tradition.
That's Cornel West, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Cornel West on the radical democratic tradition. Throughout history, there have been individuals who have challenged conventional wisdom and have stretched societal limits. Collectively, they constitute the radical democratic tradition. A sterling example of this lineage is Rosa Parks. Segregation was entrenched throughout the South. Montgomery, Alabama was one of its bastions. But on December 1, 1955, this 43-year-old activist transformed history. She refused to sit in the back of the bus and was arrested. By her simple act of courage and defiance, Rosa Parks triggered the Montgomery bus boycott, which in turn sparked the civil rights movement. Seemingly inconsequential actions can lead to momentous changes. It's hard to predict when they'll occur. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who first came to prominence during the Montgomery bus boycott, once said, "You don't have to see the whole staircase. Just take the first step." Our guest today is Cornel West. He's taught at Princeton, Harvard, Yale, and the University of Paris. He now teaches at Union Theological Seminary in New York. He's been called the preeminent African-American intellectual of his generation. With his preacher-like cadences and passionate delivery, he is much in demand as a speaker. Among his many books are Race Matters, The Rich and the Rest of Us, and Black Prophetic Fire. This classic from the AR archive was recorded in Portland, Oregon in 1995. And now, Cornel West, the radical democratic tradition.
How rare it is that I get a chance to come to Portland, Oregon. But I do plan to return frequently, there's no doubt. Because it's very clear that something is happening in Portland. No doubt about it. Something's happening in America. Something's happening in our world. Even in a moment of reaction, we can feel the stirrings of progressive and prophetic folk, recognizing that we will not only react to the right, but we will respond creatively, building on that rich tradition that has been bequeathed to us. I am but a small part of that great and grand tradition. The many thousands gone that James Baldwin wrote about with such power and perspicacity. The nameless and anonymous ones who loved and sacrificed and cared enough to transmit values that would facilitate a struggle for decency and dignity, a struggle for freedom and democracy. When I think Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Ida B. Wells Barnett, A. Philip Randolph, Martin King and Ella Baker and Fannie Lou Hamer, one cannot but be humbled by the standards that they set, standards of vision and courage and service. I think of white sisters like Lydia Maria Child, author of that powerful text published way back in 1833, Appeal in Favor of That Class of Americans Called Africans. part of the same tradition. White brothers like John Brown gave his life for the same tradition. Executed December of 1859. Thanks to Jewish brothers like August Bondi, who was with John Brown, Rabbi David Einhorn, dragged out of his synagogue in 1852 in Baltimore, owing to his unequivocal identification with the same tradition of struggle. Grace Paley, Jewish sister, still working this very day in New York City. Brown brother like Cesar Chavez. Our brown sister like Dolores Welter, who we love so much from California. Grace Boggs, Asian sister, still struggling in a chocolate city named Detroit. Ron Dukakis, fighting the good fight, right in the belly of the beast in Berkeley. Russell Means, red brother. Or Stokely Carmichael, or Diane Nash. One could go on and on and on. The tradition that I'm talking about can be classified or characterized roughly as a radical democratic tradition. By a radical democratic tradition, I mean it's a tradition that fundamentally believes each and every one of us in some way distinctive, singular, unique, irreducible, and irreproducible, and therefore warrant a certain equal treatment because there's a sanctity and dignity of each one of us, whether we're on a reservation in Montana, whether we're in East Los Angeles, whether we're in Appalachia, Harlem, or in Guatemala or Bosnia. Deep egalitarian impulse. It's not simply an egalitarian impulse, but it's an impulse we're willing to work with and act on, even against the odds. And it leads we radical Democrats to conclude that each and every one of us ought to have a say at the highest levels of the decision-making processes in those institutions that guide and regulate our lives. It sounds simple, but it is profoundly subversive. Profoundly subversive. Not just now, it has always been subversive. Used to be a brother who played organ for my church. We knew him as Sylvester. He's known to the world for the genius that he is. His name is Sly Stone. He wrote a song called Everyday People. Genius that he was, I am everyday people. I could be right, I could be wrong. My own beliefs in my song. I am no better, neither are you. We are the same, whatever we do. Sly, what are you getting at? Yes, well, in some sense, I actually echo that 16th president who had democratic sensibilities, even given the torturous decisions that he had to make, Abe Lincoln, when he said, God must love common folk. God made so many of them. That same Abe Lincoln also said, self-government is better than good government. Self-government is better than good government. It's better to make a Pascalian leap of faith on the mental and moral capacities of everyday people than to leave it up to some benevolent king or queen whose son or daughter may end up to be highly dictatorial. What Sly was getting at is something that sits at the very heart of the Radical Democratic Project. It says that there is a sense of the majestic, tragic, and problematic shot through the lives of everyday people. That their lives have depth and value and complexity and subtlety. And that is a notion that is rare in human history, because most of human history is the history of viewing everyday people as flies and fleas and weeds simply to be forced and coerced to defer to some set of unaccountable elites. The history of the human adventure, for the most part, has been the history of everyday people manipulated, exploited, and subjugated to kings and queens and princes and princesses and prelates and magistrates and potentates and lords and squires and suzerains. On and on and on. How rare it is that one can take seriously a democratic sensibility that says, our fundamental question is, what is the plight and predicament of the least of these in our society? And that we're going to empathize, we're going to sympathize with them because they're human beings just like us. And hence, ought to be able to fulfill their possibilities and potentialities, whatever they are. And we recognize a certain condition for the very possibility of democracy. There has to be freedom of speech and association and worship and movement. There's got to be some separation of power so there's mechanisms of accountability. We can talk about that in terms of separation between the judiciary and executive and legislative branches. There's got to be some representative bodies that somehow channel the voices of everyday folk such that they have some control over the conditions of their destiny. Some separation between private and public so that there's some autonomous citizenry that can always bring power and pressure to bear on those institutions that are supposed to guard and safeguard public interest and common good. And there ought to be some culture of fallibilism so no one feels as if they have unmediated access to the truth, capital T. Mutual respect, tolerance, civic trust. Those are just preconditions for the flowering of democracy. Of course, we know that the histories of democracy, human history, are such that not only are they rare, but they tend not to last that long. They're usually short-lived. And when we look at those democracies, begin to unravel. When one sees escalating poverty, that produces more and more despair. Or escalating paranoia, that produces more and more distrust, that shatters the body politic, that debases the public, that makes it very difficult for people to conceive of themselves as all being on the same ship. And recognizing that no matter where they are on that ship, if it has a leak in it, in the end, we go up together or we go down together. Nowhere to run. Nowhere to hide. I know there's a number of people from Los Angeles, San Francisco, Chicago, tried to run to Oregon. See, figuring they can get away from all of those problems. And they get here in Oregon, and there's reality staring them in the face. Same powers that be. Black brothers and sisters in Northeast. Immigrants still coming. Corporate America still moving after those profits. Nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. We either hang together or hang separately in a democracy. Martin King used to say, we're part of one garment of destiny, one inescapable network of mutuality. He's absolutely right, even though some disproportionately bear the cost and pay a price. I believe, in fact, that we're living in one of the most frightening and terrifying moments in the history of this nation. I actually believed that before the election in November. can imagine what I feel now. And what I mean by that is that, of course, any time a democracy attempts to avoid and evade and deny the pressing problems of evil, and it's clear that that democracy is losing the heroic energies requisite to keep a democracy afloat. And by problem of evil, I'm talking about unjustified suffering and unmerited pain and undeserved harm in the forms of white supremacy and its vicious legacy in this nation. It was like a serpent wrapped around the legs of the table upon which the founding fathers signed the Declaration of Independence, and it haunted America then, and 219 years later, it still haunts America. The great divide still in place. Even after de jure segregation pushed aside owing to that multiracial movement in the 1960s, we still got a problem. And male supremacy, with its pernicious effects and consequences, sits at the very center of the patriarchal institutionalized and individual practices that sit at the very center of the collective self-definition of the nation. With this dominant myth of frontier, overcoming wilderness, spreading civilization, moral regeneration through violence based on patriarchal identities, defining your humanity and conception of power in terms of who you subjugate and who you conquer. Profoundly American. It cuts across race, it cuts across class, it cuts across region. Of course, our indigenous brothers and sisters can testify to how evil that conception is in terms of dispossession of their land and the dehumanization of them. Then there's vast economic inequality, that America has been predicated on the notion of economic growth by means of corporate priorities. And if we can't grow ourselves out of a problem alongside corporate priority, then we have structural constraints on what we can do at all. That's part of the sense of impotence and helplessness that so many fellow citizens feel. And then there's homophobia. Dehumanizing of gay brothers and lesbian sisters. And so many fellow citizens and fellow human beings believe that it's just a peripheral affair, because it only affects a small number, a small percentage of the population. But you see, you can't dehumanize any slice of the human family without it having effects on all members of that family. You just can't do it. You begin to lose sight of the humanity of some, and it's just so easy to begin to lose sight of the humanity of so many others, and you end up with just you and your friends being the good folk. And then, of course, there's ecological abuse, which is linked in so many ways. It's unaccountable corporate power on the one hand, and a modernist ethos that says we must expand and grow without reflecting seriously on the cause. Look at this century. Dreadful, ghastly century. Unprecedented levels of barbarity and bestiality and brutality. Over 200 million fellow human beings murdered in the name of some pernicious ideology. Nazism at the heart of so-called civilized Europe. Stalinism at the heart of so-called emancipatory Russia. European colonialism and imperialism in the name of progress, democracy, and Christianity. Patriarchal scars and bruises left in the name of motherhood and home. What a century. What makes us think that somehow we can keep this radical democratic tradition alive? Is it the case that in the 21st century we shall see unnameable anguish and indescribable agony in the form of the gangsterization of everyday life mediated by revitalized tribalisms under the aegis of an uncontested global capitalism? That's frightening! Expansion of markets, cultural deterioration, ultimately gangsterization. The only countervailing forces, the gangsterization, parochial hatreds, market forces preoccupied with profit with very little concern with people, the only countervailing forces are democratic practices and procedures. That's what stands between where we are and the possible barbarism that could grow in the 21st century. It's already at work now. That's why what we're doing is so very important. It's not because we ourselves have some monopoly on truth. No, it's that we stand in a tradition that recognizes that without the Sojourner Truths and Martin Kings and Harvey Milks and Audre Lorde, there would be more barbarism in the world. That's why we're here. But let's look at this situation briefly. This particular moment in human history, we are witnessing unprecedented lethal linkage of relative economic decline, undeniable cultural decay, and a peculiar sense of political lethargy, all simultaneously. Never before in American history have we had to deal with all three. Never. Even during the Depression, the families remained intact. Communities were sharing. Even in the 1890s, at the end of that almost 20-year-long depression, the political system was open enough to respond to oppositional forces, populists, and so on. But we're at a moment which people are desperate, overwhelmed by such rapid changes, hungry for, thirsty for, truth tellers and witness bearers, people who will respect them enough to attempt to tell them the truth. That's what radical Democrats attempt to do. And so, as radical Democrats, we tell America, we know that economists tell us that the economy is in good shape. The Business Council just met in Williamsburg, Virginia. They were euphoric. Profits highest now. The highest profit that they've experienced since 1950s. Euphoric. The president tells us things look as if they're on course. And we say, for who? For the top 1% who own 48% of the total net financial wealth and 36% of the household wealth? Yes, I would suspect things going fairly well. The top 10% who own 86% of the wealth, or the top 20% who own 94% of the wealth? What about the 80% who's struggling over 6% of the wealth? Ask them how things are going economically. They'll tell you about stagnating wages and declining wages. Or the very poor will tell you about a depression that has been rendered invisible by the powers that be. Or industrial working class will tell you about being shattered owing to global competition and deindustrialization and industrial flight. Or an insecure middle class will tell you about layoffs and firings that corporate language defines as downsizing. Or workers will tell you about salaries of corporate executives that have increased 200% in the last 17 years at a time when workers are laid off and benefits are slashed and pensions are curtailed. It's called greed. The labor movement has got to come alive. Why? Because the power of management at the workplace push workers against the wall. Workers of all colors against the wall. And you see, what's so powerful about the labor movement is that it's one of the few places where there's still a subculture of political activism that acknowledges that anti-racism is integral to the workers' movement. We lost that in the 50s under McCarthyism. It was wiped out. And the young folks in the 60s tried to recover it so bad. And they did a good job, given the radical disruption. But one of the sadder features of our day, in this moment of relative economic decline, is so many white brothers and sisters who have no inkling of the rich anti-racist struggle against. Anti-racist struggle among white brothers and sisters in the past. I see this on college campuses, everywhere I go. Brother West, I want to be a part of this, but I don't have the first notion of how to go about it. I don't even know how to interact with black and brown and yellow folk. I wonder whether I even used the right adjective in calling them, you see. Why? Because we're so segregated. Where we live, who we talk to, who we socialize with, who we intellectualize with. You see, it makes it very difficult to build bridges. The labor movement historically has been one that had tremendous potential. That's not to say you don't have racism and sexism and homophobia in the labor movement. Of course you do. But the effort against those, as inadequate as they've been, those efforts are still quite significant. Quite significant. So in part, we're acknowledging that in a moment of relative economic decline, it is easy to understand why right-wing politicians would put forward a strategy of scapegoating the most vulnerable, frightening the insecure middle, and aiding and abetting the comfortable. And that's what we see today on Capitol Hill. Not too imaginative. But it produces great suffering and great pain. Of course, part of the problem is that for most Americans, the choice is either between a milquetoast, spineless liberalism that has not delivered, or a cold-hearted, mean-spirited conservatism that claims it can deliver. Given that swing now to the right among that majority of the 37% of fellow citizens who vote, so it's not a mass movement, but it translates into a shift of resources from working communities and poor communities to the well-to-do communities. And as radical Democrats, we have got to get our vision out there. To let people know you don't have to engage in such a false choice. There's modalities on the political spectrum that you don't know about. So we can talk seriously about your pain, whether you're a white working class brother who's fearful of downward mobility, but instructed by conservative fellow citizens to blame those below rather than those above.
You're listening to Cornel West on the Radical Democratic Tradition, a classic from the AR archive. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
I was talking to some brothers in East Peoria about a year and a half ago. They were actually members of the National Socialist Party. They showed up to my lecture and just took the whole first row. I said, Jesus, be with me. As soon as I finish lecturing, first question. Professor West. He says, you run around the country talking about this race problem, run around the country talking about white supremacy and so forth. It's people like you that are responsible for the decline of this nation, precisely because I am one who lost my job, and I lost my job because of these black folk. And I said, brother, I want to empathize with your pain. I wish you had a job, a decent paying job. But could you answer one question? How many black folk own production units in your town? None that I know of. Then you probably need a more complex analysis then, don't you? Brother sitting next to him, raise his hand. Now, I think you missed his point. He's talking about affirmative action. He lost his job to a black man. So how many black people own that job? About 2 out of 83. Ooh, they taking over though, aren't they? Scapegoating the most firm. It's a very human thing to do. It's linked to an increase in domestic violence. Brothers of all colors feeling powerless. Scapegoating and attacking the vulnerable within their own domestic space. An expression of aggression and rage and fury at their situation. And it's not a matter of just playing the race card. I don't like that term at all. White supremacy is not a card that's played. It's a reality that needs to be combated. It's not a card. We have to name it for what it is. The brother also said, well, it's that multiculturalism you're always talking about. It's that multiculturalism that's at work. I said, no, it's not that either. I said, if all black folk and yellow folk and red folk and brown folk disappeared tomorrow from America, America would still be multicultural, but there wouldn't be a debate about multiculturalism. Something called whiteness that was constructed that hides and conceals a very rich multiculturalism among brothers and sisters of European descent in America. The link between then, this relative economic decline that tilts so many toward the right given the anxiety and insecurity of social slippage and miserization and so forth, is inseparable, though not identical, with the undeniable cultural decay. And this is, in many ways, what is on the mind of most fellow citizens, the fear of violent attack. The fear of vicious assault. The fear of petty put-down, blank stares, makes the country more and more a less hospitable place. And I experienced this in going back to my own beloved Ethiopia, where I live 2.5 months every year. Materially, one of the most impoverished nations in the world, spiritually and culturally, one of the richest nations in the world. And just arriving there at the airport, Boley Airport, and seeing the smiles and the camaraderie. No funky stares, you know, wondering why you're here, and so forth. Just welcoming, I say. It's amazing. I was in Ethiopia when Mengistu was booted out in May of 1991. Here's a city, 5 million people, 1/3 of the population employed, 2/3 unemployed. It just dissolved the largest army on the continent of Africa, 300,000 soldiers returning with guns, empty stomachs. The police department itself had been transformed so that they had young people who were keeping order. And for the first 7 months, there were 4 murders during the whole period. Unintelligible in America. Inconceivable in America. Given not just the violent written character of our circumstances, but the rising cold-heartedness in our zeitgeist, in our spirit of the age. This is what I mean by cultural decay. I do not believe that there was ever a golden age in America. Never. But there was a time when our networks for caring and nurturing were more solid. And cultural decadence has to do with the relative erosion of the systems of caring and nurturing with devastating impacts for young people. And it's not just a family crisis. It's been cast as a family crisis from the right wing. And the family, of course, is in trouble, no doubt, both in chocolate cities and vanilla suburbs, no doubt about that. But we know that even when that nuclear family, usually patriarchal, was in place, it took more than two to raise children. Needed aunts and uncles and grandfathers and grandmothers and rabbis and deacons and preachers and little league coaches and dance teachers and still a little luck and grace to raise children. And what we're witnessing the shattering of that thick social web that allowed persons to move from womb to tomb in such a way that they felt as if life was worth living. It's impossible to be the featherless, two-legged, linguistically conscious creatures born between urine and feces that we are, and not want a little love and meaning and care in the short time that we're here. Because we know we all face inevitable and unavoidable and inescapable extinction someday very soon. That creates anxiety. But in a market culture, it evolves around buying and selling and promoting and advertising. What is presented as the good life is titillation and stimulation in order to consume and keep the consumption cycle of capitalism going. Down and out, go to the mall. That last semblance of public space, and just feel better about yourself by buying commodities with money you don't have. Turn on your television and engage in that dominant activity of fellow citizens watching those moving images and sound, most of those moving images, degraded images of women trying to convince us to consume as the commercials become more frequent. Television is fundamentally not about selling programs to audiences, it's about selling to audiences, advertisers. And the result is what? Market morality. Conception of the good life, which is more and more that of hooking up to a pleasure machine forever and being titillated. Looking at videos and films and television, certain slices of our young people reach the conclusion that maybe the good life is just hooking up to an orgasm machine forever and being perennially titillated. No need for conversation anymore. Let's get it on. Freak me. Rub bodies and ask what the performance level is from 0 to 10 after. And it's not solely young folk, but they are more susceptible because they have less armor against the market bombardment, which makes it difficult for them to conceive of being part of a radical democratic tradition, because radical democracy is about what? It's about preserving non-market values in a market culture. How do you do that? It was no accident that for many of us, and especially our young people, we have tremendous difficulty gaining access to bonds of affection that are genuine and networks of support that are real. ties and cords of empathy and sympathy, both within our respective communities and across those communities. There's no radical democratic tradition that does not put a premium on non-market values like love, care, concern, empathy, sympathy, fidelity, trust, community, justice, even in our intimate relations, non-market values like kindness and sweetness and gentleness. When I was growing up in Sacramento, California, we used to slow dance in garages to that Otis Redding song called Try a Little Tenderness. That's non-market, you see. That's non-market. It makes life worth living. Which means that there's a spiritual crisis along with the economic crisis linked to the cultural crisis. And there's no way that we can rejuvenate a radical democratic tradition unless we are multi-layered in our analysis such that we acknowledge the degree to which these various dimensions either impede or promote the possibility of radical democracy. This is what I mean by truth-telling, you see. And of course, I'm talking about each and every one of us because all of us are in some sense complicitous, just as we have the power to go beyond, together, what stands in our way. Relative economic decline, undeniable cultural decay, and the political lethargy, the sense of fatalism and pessimism, cynicism becoming more and more predominant in America. Of course, cynicism itself is a kind of benchmark of sophisticated intellectuality among so many of the chattering classes. Even pessimism and fatalism oftentimes becomes fashionable and faddish. And you see, part of the problem is because in a market civilization, or what Henry James called a hotel civilization, that was his characterization of America. That's why he left, of course. He went to Britain. But in a hotel civilization, which is a fusion of home and market, that's what a hotel is, right? You get the comfort and convenience of home, and you have your contract, which is what the market's about, unequal relations, asymmetric relations of power between seller and buyer, with no control of the price. But you pay your money after you've had a little comfort and convenience if you're in a decent hotel. And Henry James says, it's a very truncated conception of social life, because in such a civilization, it will tend to be preoccupied with the melodramatic and the sentimental, because it's all about happy endings and the triumph of good over evil, no matter what. Whereas radical Democrats are always raising the problem of evil in a hotel civilization, preoccupied with the sentimental and the melodramatic. Which means that if, in fact, things aren't going the way they ought with the happy ending, then it must be all or nothing. Pessimism. Ill-founded, cheap optimism, the flip side of a brooding pessimism. And what is distinctive about the radical democratic tradition is the degree to which one is able to look the worst in the face and still keep going. Because you don't subscribe to either an ill-founded optimism or a paralyzing pessimism. Instead, the tradition is about struggle, no matter what, because it's right, because it's moral, and because it's just, no matter what the consequences are. You hold on no matter what. No matter what. But you do attempt to tell the truth about how bad things are and ways in which we can accent imminent possibilities within the present. What then are we to do? I do not believe that radical Democrats have an overnight panacea or solution, but we do have directions. First thing we need is something profoundly un-American, namely a sense of history. That's what this tradition is all about. That's why we always begin accenting the tradition that serves as wind at our backs. With that sense of history, we try to broaden and deepen a sense of empathy, really want to imagine what it's like to be in the shoes of other people, even in a market-driven society in which the empathetic imagination is shrinking smaller and smaller and smaller as the walls of demarcation get thicker and thicker and thicker. Radical Democrats still proclaim that we will broaden empathy and sympathy. Secular versions of love. Love, as James Baldwin wrote about it, something daring and difficult and risk-ridden. Or saying that love of thy neighbor in all of his fullness means being able to say to him or her, what are you going through? Can I be of help? That kind of non-market love. That sense of history, expansion of sense of empathy, Radical Democrats believe fundamentally in something called courage. And there's been a shrinkage of courage these days in America, especially at the highest levels of leadership. Especially at the highest levels of leadership. On the grassroots, on the ground, there's tremendous leadership being exercised, but the television cameras don't keep track of it. So many of you represent it. But at the highest levels, it's not too much courage now. And it's amazing when you look at the American people and levels of imagination and intelligence and humor, and then look at so many of our leaders and wonder, what happened? Some kind of blockage is going on here. And of course, it has so much to do with the fact that publicness, public service, has been so trashed and so debased that very few are even willing to give time and energy to public service anymore. When you think of public education, something to run from, public transportation, something to run from, public housing, something to run from, public health care, something to run from, and most importantly, in so many ways, in a democracy, public conversation, name-calling, finger-pointing, demonizing, very, very little sense of how to enter public space without humiliation and put forth arguments and visions without ad hominem attack. John Dewey once wrote in Public and Its Problems, his famous text of 1927, show me a democracy that loses the art of public conversation, I'll show you a democracy sliding down a slippery slope to chaos and anarchy, because communication is the lifeblood of democracy. And without communication, without public conversation, there's no way that we can even begin to overcome the misunderstandings and misperceptions in various worlds. Breakdown of communication. Courage has to do with trying to keep alive the channels of communication, because that's the only means by which democratic sensibilities are preserved. And without those democratic sensibilities, there are no such thing as a radical democratic tradition. And that means trying to forge coalitions and alliances. Not simply on paper, but in our own lives. Fusing with those particular comrades in different contexts. Not trying to wrench them out of their context, but entering their context on their terms and them entering your context on your terms, but the terms being democratic terms such that the best of both contexts can be brought together to focus on bank and big business elites who have a disproportionate amount of power and influence in our society. And that's what is so necessary in the next few years if we're going to seize this opportunity. And that's not just a matter of ideals and ideology, it's a matter of experiences together. That's what made the 60s impart what it was. That white brothers and sisters didn't believe that Mississippi was a authoritarian, crypto-fascist, third world space in America until they got there and said, I can't believe it. And saying to black folks, I don't see how you all get up in the morning. This is just terrible. How could you even be in America? Well, we've been here longer than you, actually. And we put up with these scars and bruises. Let's see whether together, given the fact that you've entered this context on our terms, we can work something out together. Maybe even under black leadership. So you can help us just as we are going to help you make America be true to the best of its democratic ideals. Last but not least, you all have been very kind and patient. I think more than anything else, we need a sense of hope. But as I've suggested, hope is not the same as optimism. It's impossible to be a radical Democrat in the 20th century and be optimistic. There's not enough evidence out there in America or anywhere else in the world that would allow you to infer that things are going to get better. No optimism. But radical Democrats are prisoners of hope. That's something else. Looks at the evidence, makes a leap of faith beyond the evidence to create new evidence by energizing and galvanizing each and every one of us so that we can be the best that we can be. That's what struggle is all about. You see. That's what struggle is all about. Because radical Democrats believe that even in this dark and difficult moment that the world is incomplete and that history is unfinished and that future is open-ended, and what we do and what we think together and individually will make a difference. It will make a difference. That it is, in fact, always dawn, the day breaks forever, that above the eastern horizon, somewhere in the world, the sun is now about to peep. And all we need is just that moment, as Bobby Seale used to say, just seize that time. And now is the time to seize that time by keeping our heads to the sky, as Earth, Wind, and Fire used to sing. Keeping our hands on the plow, as Mahalia Jackson used to sing with such power. Even when what you are engaged in may take the form of unadvertised service, you're still making a difference. And if in the end we continue to push, we can mushroom to create social motion and momentum and maybe even social movements that would threaten the powers that be and force them in directions of democracy. If we keep our eyes not so much on each other's shortcomings and inadequacies, but keep our eyes on the prize, something bigger than us, something better than us, something grander than us that can appeal to the better angels of our nature, appeal to the best of us at a moment in which the worst of each and every one of us is being accented and accentuated. If we're able to do that, then we do have a chance. Then we do have a chance. But there's no guarantee. Ours is in the trying, the rest is not our business. We're not going to be here that long. We're not going to save the world or save America, but we certainly can leave it much better than we found it if we're committed to the radical democratic tradition. Well, like my grandmother used to tell me with such love in her heart, the kingdom of God is within you, then everywhere you go, you ought to leave a little heaven behind. And for radical Democrats, to leave a little heaven behind is to always be in solidarity with the poor and working people, to call for downward redistribution of wealth, to push back the white and male supremacy and homophobia, to do it programmatically and at the policy level, yes, but to be clear about your vision so that you don't go about promoting policies and programs that are severed from what your end and aim actually is. That's what we're talking about. And if we can meet this challenge, we may indeed be true to those who came before, who gave so much, sacrificed so greatly, And I simply say to those of you here in Portland, you're willing to make the challenge. I'm certainly going to be there with you because I'm going down fighting. Thank you all so very much.
That was Cornel West on the Radical Democratic Tradition. This classic from the AR Archive was recorded in Portland, Oregon in 1995. Cornel West, a prominent public intellectual and activist, teaches at Union Theological Seminary in New York. A best-selling author, he has been called the preeminent African-American intellectual of his generation. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Chris Hedges, Angela Davis, Kali Akuno, Thomas Frank, Noam Chomsky, Vandana Shiva, Russell Means, and Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. We also have a series of Cornel West programs. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.